Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk by meditation instructor Eric Weinberg continues our examination of the lives of the Karmapas. The 8th Karmapa, Mikyo Dorje, and the 9th Karmapa, Wangchuk Dorje, find more and more ways to express relative and absolute bodhicitta through blessing, art, diplomacy, healing, and writing down teachings, including practices of the oral tradition essential to bringing bodhicitta to full flower. These activities have been continuously vibrant and important right up to this day. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. I feel a little odd because right now my teacher is teaching, live streaming, and well, I hope I channel some of his mojo into here, because that would be a good thing. I'm glad to be here, though, and I'm really glad you came. I think just hearing the Dharma, even when it's presented by somebody like me, just thinking about whatever it is that comes out of a talk like this can be of a lot of benefit, and it can help the process of creating the space in our hearts of peace and good. And ultimately, that's the name of the game. So, as you're probably, most of you are aware, we're going when Lama Kathy's not here teaching, she's watching the webcast. One of us meditation instructors do the Sunday talk. And lately we've been alternating books between a book called Ultimately Perfect by His Eminence Thay Sithu, which contains the teachings of the Karmapas, and the other book, which is what we're going to be in today, The History of the Karmapas. It seemed like a good idea that, you know, we talk about the Karmapa because he's the head of the lineage. But there's a long history, and he's the 17th. So there were the 16 before him that each contributed special things that are still present. Everything continues to unfold and evolve. And it's good to understand where they're from, what the foundation is. And then there were the early teachers who came before them that originated this whole path. And it seems to me that by understanding the circumstances and the insights and the activities of previous Karmapas, it's only a benefit. It deepens our own practices. It deepens mine. So, for instance, today we'll be talking about the 8th Karmapa and the 9th Karmapa. As it turns out, the 8th Karmapa's name was Mikyo Dorje, which means immutable Vajra. So Vajra is like indestructible lightning bolt of wisdom. And immutable means this is it, you know. One of the most important guru yoga practices that we have in the Karmakaju lineage is the guru yoga of the 8th Karmapa Mikyo Dorje. There are actually two really... There are multiple guru yogas for sure, but the two most often practiced, very important, really contain a lot of blessing. And frankly, if you go through them and really contemplate what you're doing when you do those practices, I have tremendous doors open. And the other one was Karmapakshi, the second Karmapa. So we do these two a lot. They say that if you do the Guru Yoga of the eighth Karmapa, Mikyo Dorje, at the time of death for somebody who's passing, it's like the obscurations that they have that keep them from recognizing the nature of their own mind in the clear light, which is the fastest route to enlightenment if you don't make it in one lifetime, that it, this particular Guru Yoga, if they can just hear it, can open those doors. So it's important. It's part of the meditation at time of death for every practitioner in this lineage. It's something that I'm part of the care team, kind of. When one of our Sangha members is passing away, we get called often to the hospital or their home, wherever, to do the traditional Poa practice, which is the meditation at the time of death, and this is part of it. So that's Mikyo Dorje. And then, and we'll go through a lot of other stuff that he's left behind for us, lots of jewels. And then there was the ninth Karmapa, Wangchuk Dorje. And it's because of him that we actually have the practices we do at all, in a way. Up until Wangchuk Dorje, the Mahamudra practices, the highest and the most central practices of the Karmakaju, were all passed down very intimately from master to disciple. So people like us might not really ever hear those exact teachings. The ninth Karmapa was the first one to write what we use and what we call Nundro. If any of you know what Nundro is, it's called the preliminary practices. And what he understood was that it was really important for the benefit of all beings that we get on with it and not take the slow route, but really people like us who aren't necessarily monastics or yogins, but could be householders, and get on with it and really begin to practice Mahamudra and accomplish it. Because the world is a mess, and the world needs that. Nundro and Mahamudra are transformational. They are. So the Nundro means preliminary practices, and he wrote them. It's called Chariot for the Fortunate. And he wrote them so that any of us could practice them under the guidance of somebody who already had some accomplishment, not necessarily have to be enlightened, but enough that they could help us along when we get stuck. And there are two sets of preliminary practices, the ordinary foundations and the extraordinary foundations. The ordinary foundations are what's called the four thoughts that turn the mind, where you contemplate in a particular way to good effect the preciousness of this life, and you contemplate to good effect the impermanence and the fragility of all life that exists, and you contemplate to good effect cause and effect, you know, the fact that what you do matters and it's going to leave an imprint. Some people call it karma, but that's an interesting term because it means one thing in the original language, and in popular American culture, maybe it means another thing. So, but the idea that what you do matters, that everything you think, do, or say comes from causes and conditions and creates more causes and conditions. So, you know, it's important to understand the power of what you think, do, and say, and take that seriously, and therefore get spurred on to practice because our minds are wild and kind of neurotic, and we do think, do, and say things that are wild and neurotic, and we cause ourselves and others harm. And this whole idea is nonviolence. It's to do no harm, really, bottom line. And the last of the ordinary foundations is titled the Defects of Samsara. The defects of samsara, it's basically thinking that, you know, how we hope and dream that if we do everything just right, we're going to get what we want. And if we're really unlucky, that'll happen. And because ultimately, if that's the way it goes, we will have accumulated all kinds of self-aggrandizing, narcissistic imprints in our minds that are only going to cause trouble ultimately. So that's the defect of samsara. It's really attractive. It's really sexy. There's a lot of stuff we want. We all want different things, but we all have that same infinite capacity for wanting stuff and wanting to avoid stuff and being totally uninterested in probably the important stuff. Those are the three mental poisons. So it's a way of contemplating that and recognizing that ordinarily we're trapped in some kind of a neurosis that has us circling around that fishbowl. And once you really get it, it's like actually a little weepy. And it gives you good motivation to want to, okay, tame the mind. It also gives you good motivation to want to do it as quickly as possible. Because once you understand that, you realize, oh man, I don't want to hang around in this neurosis longer than necessary. So that's where you get the four extraordinary preliminaries, which is starting out with refuge in bodhicitta, where you understand that you can come out of that reign of neurosis into, get this, show and tell, the reign of wisdom by training the mind, by going for refuge to the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, the three roots, Lama, Yidam, Dakini, and cultivating bodhicitta, both kinds, which is moving from worrying about I, me, and mine all the time to worrying about us. That's relative bodhicitta. And then ultimately realizing that every single one of you and everything that appears and exists as far as I can see is a part of me, and I'm a part of it. And having a direct realization of that is ultimate bodhicitta. So those are actually meditation practices. And then there's a purification practice, and then there's an offering practice. Purification obviously is a way of dealing with already accumulated imprints in our minds and karma. And then the offering practice is a way of amplifying ultimate bodhicitta, because in a sense you're offering everything to everything, and you're accumulating merit through generosity for sure, but you're also amplifying this insight that everything's connected. And then lastly, there's guru yoga, which is understanding that ultimately making that last leap over depends on blessing. It depends on your intention. It depends on creating the causes and conditions for it, which is your responsibility. But it also depends, but it mostly depends on blessing. So doing the guru yoga is a way of creating the causes and conditions for receiving that blessing. Anyway, that all came from the ninth Karmapa, and he gave us that. And then, this is like Passover's coming. I don't know how many Jewish people are here. There's a prayer called Dayenu, means it's like if he would only done that, it would have been enough. But wait, there's more. He also wrote the texts that are used to this day to teach Mahamudra. There are three main texts, and there are lots of other ones too. He did a lot, 30 books or something. But the three main ones that you will probably encounter sooner or later on the path are the Ocean of Certainty, Eliminating the Darkness of Ignorance, and Pointing Out the Dharmakaya. I brought with me Kempo Kartha Rinpoche's commentary on Pointing Out the Dharmakaya today. As you can see, it's well-worn. And what my intention is to tell you a little bit about each of these karmapas today. There isn't enough time to really talk about it all. Their work, what they accomplished in their lifetimes was truly extraordinary. And I have to tell you, before I'll cut to the chase, they did it all by the time they were in their mid-40s. They passed away, both of them, in their late 40s. So, I mean, I'm already 50% older than them and haven't done too much yet. So when I read it, I become very inspired. As we always do, though, I'd like to start just by recalling this place and who we are in this place and what we receive in terms of teaching and just space to receive the teaching by chanting together the refuge prayer. I will chant it three times in Tibetan. If you know it and would like to follow along, that'd be great. If you don't know it, please don't have feelings like outsider feelings. Instead, follow along in your heart, recognizing that we're all Buddhists to be. Some people like Karmapas and Shakyamuni Buddha and so on are Buddhas, and they're here to bless us. So we're blessed from the inside and the outside, that the teachings, the Dharma, come from these teachers, but also easily are imprinted and reside in our hearts. And that we're supported completely by each other as Sangha. So those are the three refuges. And if you can just rest in that, that's every bit as powerful as chanting along with me. Sanje Chudang Soki Chognam La Jang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi Jin So Ki Pe Sunam Ki Drola Penshir Sanje Drupar Sho Sanje Chudong So Ki Chognam La Jang Chu Pardu Dagni Kyab Suchi Dagi jin so ki pe so nam gi drola pen shir sanje drupar sho sanje chudong so ki chok nam la chang chu pardu dagni kyap su chi Dagi jin so ki pe so nam ki Drola pin shir sanje rupar Cho. Well, the eighth Karmapa, Mikyo Dorje, lived from 1507 to 1554. You know the Karmapa Cheno mantra that we chant sometimes? That originated with him. He gave that to us. It's interesting that what I said about the ninth Karmapa followed that. So first we started with Karmapa Cheno. He gave us a link in a way. And then once that link was solidified through his lifetime, then, you know, it's like that whole mental web page got populated with the Ma Mudra teachings. For the first time, they were really disseminated widely. Like all Karmapas, the seventh Karmapa left a prediction letter of where they find him and what the signs would be that he was reborn and so on and so forth. And so a child was born, and lots of stuff was going on, atmospheric things, and the child was kind of interesting. He wasn't just crying, but sounded like words. And, you know, in the last testament of the seventh Karmapa, he had predicted the way all that would go. And this little village he was born in recognized that an extraordinary child had been born. And they let the previous Karmapa's heart son, the Taisitu, know that they thought that they had an extraordinary child. So Taisitu interviewed the parents and said, you know, what's going on? And when he heard what was going on, it really matched the prediction letter. The little village and the mountains matched what the location was supposed to be and so on. So they decided they would test him out. They don't just go by that. They're really kind of rigorous. And they called up. They were no phones. They got word to Serpum. I don't know. Maybe they had, what do they have in Harry Potter? You know, the owls. They sent an owl down to central Tibet to Serpum Monastery where the Shamar Rinpoche was and was the seat of the Karmapas and said, hey, send up some of the implements of the, you know, seventh Karmapa and previous Karmapas. And so he did. He sent a bunch of monks and sent the black action crown that Karmapas wear and different implements that he used to use ritually and stuff like that. And then they mixed them all up with a bunch of other stuff they had, some real shiny bling new stuff and, you know, things that kids like shiny stuff, you know. And they put them in front of this child, and without hesitation, he just chose the ones that were his. That's one of the tests. And then after they'd identified him, this is kind of interesting given how things have evolved over the years. Taisitu was convinced that they had the right child. But he said, keep it under your hat for a while. So they didn't enthrone him, give him a name, do anything like that. He wasn't named Mikyo Dorje yet. That's given at his enthronement and his first ordination. And the reason was there was a little political unrest in the lineage, and Taisitu either knew about it or sensed it was coming, and somebody identified a competing child as Karmapa. So this happened with the 8th. You know, we've just gone through some of this stuff with the 17th, some of you know. So it's not new. These kind of things do happen. And what was interesting was they brought the other kid in. So it helped that the supporters were friendly with each other. There wasn't a political divide. And they went through the testing procedures of identifying the Karmapa, and everybody agreed it was the first one I talked about. And the kid was just a few years old, 3 or 4 by that time. And both kids were. They were born around the same time, different places, though. And so as soon as Mikyo Dorje was identified as Karmapa, it's kind of like he said that, and he said, yeah, but this other kid is an important tulku from the Karmakaju lineage, and told him which incarnation he was, which is kind of cool. So that was, Mikyo Dorje was known for identifying reincarnated lamas and stuff like that, tulkus. So that was his first identification. They named him Mikyo Dorje because Guru Rinpoche, who used to be over there, he's not there now. Guru Rinpoche, during his time, actually wrote his own prediction letter, his own prophecy, that there would be this line of people called the Karmapas, and Karmapa means activity of the Buddha. And he said the first one should be named this, and the second one that, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So whenever a Karmapa is identified, they go refer back to the original prophecy, and they grab the ordination name from the prophecy of Guru Rinpoche. Interesting. When they asked him who he was, I think he must have been, I don't remember the ages perfectly well, but probably 7 or 8 years old. He said, well, you know, I can be anybody, and my activity is everywhere. And I was Padmasambhava, and I was Saraha, and I was, and then that night, and which is kind of true, because enlightened mind is enlightened mind. Different mind streams, but still they share the same aspiration and activity. But then he had a dream, and Guru Rinpoche came to him in a dream. This guy had a lot of dreams, and said, actually, you were one of my 25 main disciples, and you and I actually share the same mind. Which is what they say about the 25 original disciples of Guru Rinpoche. He had a lot of visions like that. Now, in the book, they skip right here to the place where he's 32 years old already. I'm going to not do that, but we'll come back. In 1516, however, so now he's 9 years old, okay? He went to visit Jang Sa Tam, and he was a king in Yunnan. And the king had a lot of doubts about Buddhism. He wasn't, like, a big fan. But he was interested because the Karmapas, if you've heard some of the previous talks, they've always been invited to give teachings at different Mongol courts and different, you know, kings and all of that have been fans because they seem to be kind of powerful and magical, and kings like magical and powerful things. And apparently when he appeared, the elephants actually kneeled and raised their trunks, and there were like big thunderclaps and a lot of like strange stuff went on. The king took it as a sign that this might be the real deal. Then this 9-year old proceeded to teach the Dharma to this king of this country, and they ended up having a great relationship. The king decided he was going to follow the Buddhist path. He got some monks to stay and be teachers, and it was really important because 2 Karmapas later, during the time of the 10th Karmapa, the Mongol hordes invaded Tibet, and there were some warlords that were also like kind of unruly, and the 10th Karmapa had to be on the run the whole time. He had what was called the Great Encampment, which had been established earlier, but rather than just being a group that went around giving teachings and blessing monasteries and building buildings and so on and so forth, this was like running away from the Mongol hordes to survive. And so this is like, you know, 100 years later, just about, they were welcomed at this place, Zhang Sa Tam. And that had to do with the 8th Karmapa at 9 years old opening the door. It's kind of cool. In 1517, he met the first Sanjay Nyempa, who was the heart son of the 7th Karmapa, and they began his education, formal education. He was good at language. He was like, he wrote Sanskrit texts on Sanskrit grammar. No kidding. That's pretty arcane. And he became well known for being a master of the sciences of the time and all of that kind of thing. At that time, there's this king, Wuzong, who was the 11th emperor of the Ming Dynasty, invited him to Beijing. And Karmapa had a vision of two suns in the sky and one of them collapsing to the ground, to the earth. And he knew that was inauspicious to be traveling to Beijing. And these guys who the King Wuzong had sent, apparently had sent like enormous wealth, lots of gold, lots of elephants, lots of silks, lots of brocades, lots of tea, lots of everything he had. And these guys got so pissed off when Karmapa said, no, I'm not going with you. Signs are inauspicious. They took them all back and they went back to Beijing. And sure enough, Wuzong died before they even arrived back in Beijing. And the Ming Dynasty over the next 100 years fell apart because Wuzong, turns out, was more interested in the, let's say, pleasures of the court than he was about administering his country. And his eunuchs, it's in there. His eunuchs kind of took over, the bureaucrats, I guess, right? And they took all the power away. And so after he died, it just became fractious. And none of the Ming emperors after him were ever able to consolidate power again. Till the end of the Ming Dynasty, somewhere in the middle of, I think, 17th or early 18th century. It said middle of 17th. Okay. So anyhow, these dreams he would have, there are a couple main dreams. He did some other stuff. He established really a high academic standard. And at the beginning, there were two views, let's say, two views of the middle way. One's called Shentong, one's called Rongtong. We're not talking about that right now. But most Karmapas hold the Shentong view. And this is a big thing. I mean, literally physical battles were fought over this. These were debates that went a little crazy. By the end of his life, he wrote a 300 or 400 page textbook on Rongtong, which has become the seminal text on that for Karmakaju and the 16th Karmapa, said one of the most important texts on the middle way that was ever written. So the point of that is that he was way beyond, this is what we believe, this is what we do, we don't do that. He was really interested in accumulating insight on all of that. And so to that end, he accumulated this book here, which in English is titled The Reign of Wisdom, that has the stories of the great masters of the Karmakaju, including him, and the poems that they wrote. And these poems are often read. I mean, as practices in a lot of monasteries, it's said that people who hear them and understand them and study them actually can open the doors to enlightenment. They're very powerful. So when he was 32, he wrote, "On the night of the new moon of the seventh month, I had a dream in which I saw the earth and sky swirling together with colors flashing forth, bright red, bright green, pure blue, and bright white. Unsupported in the midst of the pure azure sky, Lord Dusum Kempa, who is the first Karmapa, suddenly appeared. He was wearing the three robes of a monk and the black crown. His hands were in the meditation posture. His appearance was extremely vivid, and his legs loosely crossed. My mind was utterly overwhelmed, and for a little while, there were no thoughts." Get that. This is Karmapani saying, "For a little while, I had no thoughts." You know, we're like hard on ourselves because we're having a hard time calming down. I've just had to say that. Then as thought arose again, Dusum Kempa dissolved into variegated colors. Light rays of inexpressible colors filled the sky, in the midst of which fell a rain of nectar and a colored array of flowers. The following day, I remained enraptured from the time I awoke until noon. I thought I would not proclaim this experience to others, but then, because I felt so overwhelmed with joy, I wrote down this account and supplication." So I won't read the whole supplication to you, but the last stanza, to give you a flavor of what it looks like when somebody authentic actually has a vision like this. This is the last stanza. "May I not insensibly amass obstacles through the eight worldly dharmas?" Do you know what the eight worldly dharmas are? Yes, no? I will tell you. I always do this. I footnote myself when I practice because there's always eight of this and ten of that, and I never know what it is. So, the desire for happiness and the wish to avoid suffering, the desire for fame and the desire to avoid insignificance, the desire for praise, the desire to avoid blame, the desire for gain, and the desire to avoid loss. We occupy ourselves all day long with those eight, wanting this and not wanting that. And those are called the eight worldly dharmas. And they are the fundamental basis for being trapped in the neurosis and suffering of samsara. So, just so you know what he's talking about. "May I not insensibly amass obstacles," being attached to those things, we amass obstacles, "through the eight worldly dharmas, and so eat my heart raw. May I not be contaminated by evil deeds, disastrous to self and others. And may I die poor and humble. Father Jetson Repa, grant your blessings." That's some powerful stuff. That's how Karmapa's, that's the end of that particular thing. He wrote a number of songs. And of course, we don't have time. And I want to just leave you with that taste of the eighth Karmapa. So on to the ninth. Well, I will say this. One more thing about him. He thought he was going to die pretty young. His activity was pretty vast. And he was pretty worn out. And I think it was like when he was 37 or 39, he told his attendants, I'm about ready to go. And they begged him not to yet. And so in the last part of his life, he actually did a lot of writing. And it's said that because of what he wrote and what he taught and his last trip around in the encampment, he was able to extend the lineage by double or triple, just because he was able to pass on so much more that it could stay alive, you know? Then in the last encampment, he had an open door policy, which is unusual because these guys are treated like real royalty and you have to get past, you know, their attendants and the palace guard, so to speak, in order to see him. And he said, no, we're not doing that. I want anybody who wants to make a connection with me should be able to make a connection. And he got to a place in the south where they were having an outbreak of leprosy. And the people were suffering a lot. This is another thing karmapas do. So he built 8 black stupas that represented the disease. Was it 8? No, it was 5. I'm sorry. And then he sat in the middle of them. It's the 8th karmapa, different number of stupas. Then he sat in the middle of them and did purification practice. According to the local histories, the outbreak of leprosy was cured. I mean, it just stopped. People got better. And then he went to one of his monastic colleges that was nearby, and within a few days, he manifested a serious signs of having taken on that leprosy himself. And he passed away within a day. The prediction letter that he had written, get this, 20 years before. So when he was in his 20s. And he handed it over to Shamar Rinpoche, who was at that particular monastic college. And he said, don't worry, I won't be gone long. And then in 1556, in early 1556, the 9th Karmapa, Wangchuk Dorje, was born. And once again, they found him because of the prediction letter. Right where they were told they would have to look. His discovery was made known to the Thai Situ. And they sent, you know, various emissaries and identified him and then brought him back to Karmagon, which was the main monastery up there. It was Thai Situ's monastery. It's 1:15 after, so I can't give this as much time as I wanted. But I'll say, give you a few highlights of this. The 9th Karmapa was enthroned at the age of 5, and he essentially spent his whole life moving around in his encampment. He didn't, it's interesting, he didn't want to be sitting on a high chair somewhere having people kissing the ring all the time. He did do some of that. You know, he'd go somewhere, there he'd be, and that kind of stuff would happen, but he didn't stay there. He did a lot of retreat. He did retreat in the caves above Serpu, where Longchenpa, the famous Nyingma master, did his most important retreats. He did retreat where Padmasambhava Guru Rinpoche did his retreats in Bhutan. And very importantly, he did some things that actually helped people that were not just adherents and monks get a taste of the Dharma, like finally writing down the Mahamudra texts I told you about. He also did this incredible thing. He commissioned a huge tanka, you know, but I mean, we're talking about something that I think they said it was 30 meters by 20 meters. So it was 66 feet by whatever. It was a lot, big. And it was a done in the style of painting that was essentially created in the encampment of the eighth Karmapa called Karmagadri. And that's the style of tanka that that is. It's called Karmagadri, where you've got like Chinese colors, Indian figures, and a sense of landscape and depth. Not all tankas are like that. There were three styles. So they did it like that, and they did it with an applique technique. They bought, you know, a bajillion yards of really fine fabric and had people kind of mosaic them together. And once a year on Sagadawa, which is the anniversary of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and parinirvana, they'll unroll it on the side of the mountain opposite the Serpu Monastery. And then they do Chamdan dances, Lama dances, and everything in between for a few days. And the idea was is that this would be a powerful thing and there could be liberation on seeing. People would see it and something would wake up in them. It's a pretty extraordinary thing. He had a heart for the people. Let's just put it that way. Anyway, he created this gigantic tanka so everybody could see. He designed it and had all kinds of things. He also, as part of the encampment, went to Sikkim for the first time. People there were kind of like interested in practice, but they just knew, you know, they say these words, they didn't know what they meant. It's kind of, they were rudimentary Buddhists. And he decided he wanted to teach them deeply, and he established three monasteries there, one of which was Rumtek. And as some of you might know, that after the Chinese invaded in 1959, so we're talking, what, 300 years later, because of the relationship the ninth Karmapa made with the king of Sikkim, that lasted 300 years, and the fact that he thought ahead and built a monastery there, but actually three, he had a place to go. That's where the Karmapas went when Mao Zedong and the Red Army invaded Tibet. Something Joe and I and Ron were talking about before. They say that the Karmapas are the knowers of the three times. And when you read through these biographies, you actually see that. For me, I mean, there's a woo-woo part of it, kind of miraculous. But on another level, it gives me great confidence and comfort because here we are. This is his house. And to think that he doesn't understand that you showed up today, to think that he's not offering his blessings to you right now would be wrong thinking. So all you have to do really is open your heart and have a little tape loop in there of the mantra that the eighth Karmapa gave us, Karmapa Cheno, which means Karmapa know me. And what the Karmapas have all said ever since is they'll be present to you. It's an incredible blessing. So there's part of pointing out the Dharmakaya. Here's what he says. Here, in order to practice the heart essence of all of the Buddhas of the three times, the heart essence of all Buddhas of three times means that which was realized and taught by the Buddhas of the past that which is realized and taught by the Buddhas of the present, and that which will be realized and taught by the Buddhas of the future. Which instructions have passed down person to person in an oral lineage from Maha Vajradhara, who's the primordial Buddha, down to the victor Kunchuk Yenlak, which was the fifth Sharmapa, the ninth Karmapa's guru, without being interrupted by any other lineage. The warmth of blessing and the breath of the Dakinis has not dissipated. In other words, this is fresh. When you receive this, it's as fresh today as it was when Talopa first received it. So that was the blessing that he was trying to spread. And of course, trying to spread it because he actually could see things unfolding. For instance, there was a monk named Sonam Jamso, who is a Gelugpa, who was very powerful and actually wanted to receive teachings from the ninth Karmapa and did. And he became recognized as the third Dalai Lama. Then retroactively, since he was a tulku, they said, well, his previous two incarnations were the first and the second. It's interesting. But there was a connection made between the Karmakaju lineage and the Gelugpa lineage of the Dalai Lamas, that has lasted to this day. I mean, 17th Karmapa lived under the protection of the 14th Dalai Lama in India when he finally escaped Tibet. So all of these things, again, are important. And that's why we go back right to the beginning of doing something like Nundro, where we're creating powerful and positive implants on our minds. It's because it's not just in this lifetime. This lifetime, we could end up like the end of that poem. You could even pray for that, to be poor and, you know, with nothing at your death. But as your mind stream unfolds in lifetime after lifetime, you can begin to be a part of a great stream of incredible blessing if you create the causes and conditions for that. So that's kind of the message of all of that. Obviously, I have given short shrift to these two extraordinary Karmapas. But it's 25 after. So I'm going to break here. And if there's anybody who has any questions or comments, or if you want to hear a little more, just go to the question mic and let's open that up. Yes.
What was the... Because you started mentioning all those, you know, texts that I'm going to mispronounce his name.
Mikyo Dorje.
Dorje wrote, which now, well, my first question is, where is there an easy place I can find the list?
Probably, I don't know.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm not sure that all of them have been translated. Mostly the work so far, you know, it's very... Buddhism very new to the West.
Right.
And most of what was translated first were Wangchuk Dorje's, ninth Karmapa's texts. What we've got from Mikyo Dorje, as far as I understand it, is like the songs in here in the Reign of Wisdom.
Right.
And they're great.
Well, okay, follow-up question. You mentioned that he had written... A text on the wrong...
Yes.
Do you know the name of that text?
No.
Okay.
It's not translated.
Oh.
No. But it's...
Are you going to get on that? No.
Yeah. Next life.
Okay.
Yeah, as far as I know, but it's taught in the Tibetan Shedras. You know, it's a main text, but I don't think anybody's tackled that yet.
This was a really great... discussion today, because I mean, I've seen on the KTD website, you know, Tenpo Kartho Rinpoche has done, He might have done a 10-day teaching in the last couple of years, but I've definitely seen, like, you know, on this Karmapa, and I didn't know anything about him, really. I didn't know a whole lot about him, and I'd heard his name, and I kind of knew who he was, but I didn't really understand the importance. So I really, this was a great teaching today for me.
Thank you. So. Yeah, at KTD, they teach the Guru Yoga, so there are occasionally retreats. I think they're wonderful. I highly recommend them. When we have our new center built, I would imagine that we've had people come a couple times to teach that here. And Kempo Kartha Rinpoche has taught a lot of the Ninth Karmapa texts. Yeah. Like this one. This was, I think this was one 10-day teaching. Yeah. So, anybody else? I can't believe we'll be on time. I'm almost never on time.
Do you remember, I think, yeah, there was a Tanka at the center, the old center of Mikyo Dorje.
Yes, there was. And that's for the, it was for the practice.
A circle of things around him.
Yes.
I forget.
Dakinis.
Yeah. I always, that was the eighth Karmapa.
Yes. It's a part of that Guru Yoga is, it's interesting. He was the one who took on all the leprosy at the end of his life. And that, what that's depicting is a part of that Guru Yoga that's a very powerful purification practice. And So he's really identified with that, with purification, healing, and that's a really extraordinary practice for that. I think I have something here. Let's see if I can find it. Okay, I'll give you a prayer to end up with. We can use it as the dedication of merit. So in your heart, just dedicate the merit of hearing about these Karmapas, and I'll read this prayer to you. It's from the Guru Yoga in the Nundro, written by the Ninth Karmapa. So visualize the Lama Karmapa on top of your head and pray that you may give birth to compassion and bodhicitta. Lama Rinpoche, La Solwa Deb. Lama Rinpoche, I turn to you. Dagjin Lo Yi Tong War Jinji Lo. Bless me that my mind give up its ego clinging. Gome Gyula Kye War Jinji Lob. Bless me that contentment arises in my stream of being. Chumin Nam To Gampar Jinji Lob. Bless me that non-dharmic thoughts may cease. Rangsem Kye Me Togpar Jinji Lob. Bless me that my mind be realized to be unborn and undying. Trulwa Rangshar Jiwar Jinji Lop. Bless me that illusion be at peace in itself. Nangsi Chu Kurtogpar Jinji Lop. Bless me that the mind in all its manifestations be realized to be the Dharmakaya. So with this prayer, we offer the space in our hearts, the open, luminous space of Dharmakaya, filled with these jewels, to the whole world, every living sentient being without exception, that peace and good would manifest. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.